This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Ross Perot can tell you, running for president of the United States isn't cheap. As you know, big money often comes with big strings attached. In the 70s, campaign finance reforms were enacted to limit special interest funding of candidates. But big loopholes have opened up that system to what has been described as legal graft. Donors are prohibited from giving more than $1,000 to an individual candidate, but there are no such limitations on the amount that can be given to a political party. Money given to the party is called soft money, and it's supposed to be used for indirect activities like generic party advertisements and get-out-the-vote drives. But the money is often used to fund specific campaigns and sometimes seems to influence the candidate's policies. Robert Krulwich investigates this in the new Frontline documentary called The Best Campaign Money Can Buy. You can see it tonight on public television. Krulwich is a CBS economic correspondent. He used to be the economics reporter for NPR. He found the Republicans and the Democrats have clubs for large donors. Democrats who give at least $200,000 can join the managing trustees.
It's a high entry fee. You have to give the Democratic Party, not Bill Clinton, but the Democratic Party, $200,000 of your own money or more. If you do that, you get this managing trustee moniker. And that entitles you to sort of silly privileges. You can go to the national conventions and sit in the Sky booth. You can have briefings from members of the campaign. And you get to meet all the other managing trustees, which, at least on the Republican side, turned out to be a big deal. And you also, presumably, will have your calls returned later on when your candidate is elected, if he is.
So for the Democrats, they have the managing trustees at $200,000 per person. The Republicans have Team 100. What do they have to pay to get in?
Well, now here's a switch. You'd think the Republicans would charge $350 if the Democrats are charging $2, but the Republicans, you can get into their Team 100 group at $100,000. And so for $100,000 to the Republican Party, you become a Team 100 member. The Team 100 organization has been around for a longer time, and they are a fascinating group of people. They are all mostly self-made, very rich people, as are the Democrats. They're a little older than the Democratic group, and they do things together in season and out of season. They take trips together to Eastern Europe. They go to Russia. They get briefings at the White House with during the non-political years. And they have joint events. I got the impression over time that for the Republicans on the Team 100 group, being in the group was a kind of networking Jerry Rubin-style club in which politics was a reason to get together, but hardly the main reason. It seemed to be just a gathering of big businessmen who do business with each other.
Well, if I paid my $100,000 or $200,000 to be in this Democratic or Republican club, what would I get in return besides the perks? I mean, how much access would I get to my candidate?
That is hard to say specifically. It's quite clear that if you're in that group, when you call the White House or when you want to visit a senior member of the administration on the Republican side, because as you may recall, we only had Republican presidents recently, you do get the appointment. Beyond that, on the Democratic side, I suppose it's the anticipation of making the calls and getting the access is driving some of them. Beyond that, though, I think there's a sort of trophy president feeling. You know, this man is your president. A lot of these guys have pictures, you know, of themselves with the candidates and of themselves beautifully and very personally autographed by the candidate. And they have a very strong personal loyalty, it seems. But in our documentary, we take it the next step. One of them, Howard Leach, who's a member of the Team 100 group, he gets into an automobile in the springtime with President Bush, and they go for a ride to a rally that Howard Leach is sponsoring for George Bush as a candidate, and they're talking. Howard Leach describes the conversation. He says, "Mr. President, you know what we really need in the valley in California is we need more water for the businessmen down here. Water, as we all know, falls from heaven in the northern part of California and then flows through various viaducts and so on to the southern part of California. The federal government subsidizes and controls the movement of water in much of California, and it is within the power of the president to move great gobs of water from the north to the south. Howard Leach wanted the water moved from the north to the south, and 9 days after that ride in the car, President Bush, by his own order, moved hundreds of millions of gallons of water from the north to the south part of California. As a result, and you'll see this in the documentary, Farmers and fishermen in the north lost water, so much so that salmon died en masse, and the businessmen in the south got the water. Congress is now trying to override that act. Howard Leach says nothing that happened in that car, even though they had the conversation, there was nothing like a quid pro quo. He insists on that, and he says it was just good common sense that caused President Bush to move the water south. But that's what he says.
Let's look at big business interests. I think the biggest of the big is ADM, which I think our listeners might know as Supermarket to the World, because that's the way they advertise themselves on the commercials. Mm. It's a big agribusiness concern, also a producer of ethanol.
Right.
And in your Frontline special, you have some stuff on Dwayne Andreas, who is the CEO of ADM. And he was the largest donor of the year.
Which is interesting because he's been around for so long. You'd think if the campaign financing laws had worked and public money had replaced private money, then Dwayne Andreas would go away from the scene. You can go back to Hubert Humphrey's campaign for president in the late 60s. Dwayne Andreas gave him, or was indicted for giving him, an illegal sum of money. And then Richard Nixon received money from Dwayne Andreas. Some of the money that went to the Watergate burglars, $25,000, allegedly came from Dwayne Andreas. It was money that he gave in a golf course. In our documentary, we discovered Dwayne Andreas in the Watergate files. We happened upon a document, an interview with Rosemary Woods, in which she vividly describes Dwayne Andreas, same guy, arriving with a manila envelope containing $100,000 in $100 bills given personally to President Nixon and kept in the White House safe for a year. Well, this same fellow from 20 years ago doing it then is this year's, as you just said, number one contributor, not only to the Republican Party, but to the Republicans and the Democrats. He's back.
Well, he gave, I think, $1 million to the Republicans and $100,000 to the Democrats.
No more than $137,000, I think.
What do you think he got in return for his donation to the Republicans?
This year, as you said, Dwayne Andreas makes a product from corn called ethanol. It's a subsidized fuel added to gasoline or substituted for gasoline, and it does require the constant attention and support of the U.S. government to market it against cheaper and arguably cleaner fuels. This year, President Bush, in the middle of the campaign, created a waiver that would allow ethanol to be marketed and essentially the government subsidize it further, just exactly what Dwayne Andreas wanted. It will be worth a great deal to his company and to the corn farmers who supply him.
One of the things I found really interesting in your Frontline special is that Dwayne Andreas, the head of ADM, has a vacation condo in Florida. And in the same building are a lot of other very influential people whose names our listeners will recognize. You want to run through the list?
Yeah, this is really a mystery of sorts. There's a place on Collins Avenue in Miami, actually just north of the city line, in North Miami. It's not a particularly beautiful place or anything. It's sort of a plaster of Paris, stucco kind of verandas looking out over the sea against the sort of what's left of Miami Beach after the hurricane kind of place. In that place, however, in the penthouse, sits Dwayne Andreas, who's the head of Archer Daniels Midland. The program that Archer Daniels Midland sponsors, this week with David Brinkley happens to live there. And one of the correspondents who's the star of that program, Sam Donaldson, just happens to live there. And the Speaker of the House, former Speaker of the House of the Democratic Party, who had a wonderful retirement dinner given to him by Dwayne Andreas, which raised several million dollars, Tip O'Neill, he just happens to live there. And one of the big corn senators and a frequent candidate for president, Bob Dole, and his wife, Elizabeth Dole, a member of the Bush cabinet, just happened to live there. And Jack Stevens, who was one of the major contributors to the Clinton campaign and a major presence also in the Republican circles out of Arkansas, just happens to live there. It's just a weird tangle of influential people all under the same roof.
What do you make of it?
Well, they're all friends. And in a really interesting interview, another member of that household, as it were, Bob Strauss, currently the ambassador to the Soviet Union, who also is there. I said, how come all of these people are under this same roof? He says, well, you know, we're all friends, and We may be combatants during the day, but when after dark in Washington, we all get together. And what a nice thing to do around Christmas time is to all come down to the place and, you know, be together. And we are the good people, suggesting that whoever wins this election, the good people who live under that roof, will all get together and do their deals and have their relationships, regardless of who's in the White House. There's sort of a, as everybody knows, there's a crowd, and this is one of their hangouts, and there they all are. And they do deal with each other, you know, constantly.
Do you think that there's more than friendship beneath it?
Sure. I mean, this is the centrist faction of the political society. These are the people who talk about the nation in front of us, and the people who do a lot of the commerce, and the people who work in the legislature. I don't know that there's anything dark going on under the roof. It's just it's so cozy. That's the main thing. You're looking at the cozy center here.
Robert Krulwich is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is reporter Robert Krulwich, and he reports a Frontline special tonight called The Best Campaign Money Can Buy, and it's about political financing. Your Frontline show follows Bill Clinton as he got an early start with big money in the primaries. Do you think that early start with big money was responsible for, or one of the things that was responsible for him becoming the front runner?
No question. Had Bill Clinton not raised the most money the fastest, he wouldn't be where he is today.
How did he do it?
Well, that's an interesting tale also. The documentary begins with a gathering on the at the estate of Pamela Harriman. We take you all the way back to a point where the prospect of the Democrats winning the White House was just as extremely distant, as distant as it could be. The president had just won the war. He was riding an all-time high wave of popularity. And Ron Brown and Pamela Harriman had a little party. They invited many of the people who had given $100,000 or more in the previous campaign to come to the meeting. So there were envelope stationery kings. There were Hollywood moguls. There were folks from Miami who run hospice centers. Some of them were youngish. There were some in their upper 40s, many of them in their lower 50s. Some of them beginning to go into retirement at that age. Some people can do that. And they all met and drafted a statement of principles. They wanted to see a more business-like candidate, and they wanted to see a more centrist platform if they could get it. Ron Brown said to him, but what we really want to do is we want to create a group of people, and we want you to pay for them, by the way, you guys, who will be the early computer people, the early research people, the early outreach people, the early contributions people, the early issues people, a campaign in embryo sitting there and waiting. You'll pay for them. And now let's invite the candidates up to this estate and ask them, if they are nominated by the party, will they use them? Will they promise to use the structure we set up so that when the campaign begins, they'll have answers right away to charges, they'll have money right away to move, they'll have professionals right away to advance them, and so on. And so candidates came to this meeting and were screened by these businessmen and made their various promises. This group was not a group that picked the candidate, hardly. They didn't have that kind of power. But they could make their preference for a more centrist candidate known, and they got pledges of support and willingness to do it from several of the candidates, including Bill Clinton, who was there, among others.
What do you think Bill Clinton might have given in return for the financial support that he got?
Well, we described then the three places where he touched money early in the campaign. He had his friends, the Stevens family in Arkansas, who are, by the way, religiously Republican folks and big supporters of President Bush, nevertheless gave the Clinton campaign money because they do a lot of business with the Arkansas government. But they also gave Bill Clinton, during his dry period, a huge amount of credit. They gave him several million dollars of bank credit in a bank that the Stevens family is a major stockholder of. So that was good to start with. Second, he went to New York City and met a wonderful guy on Wall Street, who had just, he's in his early 50s, Ken Brody, and he just retired from Goldman Sachs. And he spent a good part of the winter raising money for Bill Clinton. And there were an awful lot of people who were in their late 40s who liked him and gave him money. And the third stop, we point out, is in, of all places, South Florida, where Bill Clinton, in an act of some bravado, goes in to Little Havana. You can't find in the United States a group of people more inclined to vote for a Republican candidate for president than Cuban Americans in South Florida. And yet he boldly walked in where no Democrat had yet gone and made a key promise to that group that opened up the territory for him, both for money and for votes. He promised that he would support a very, very stiff bill to fence in Fidel Castro, a very, very tough trade embargo, which even President Bush, the free trader, would not endorse. Bill Clinton went in under Bush's nose and endorsed the bill and opened up some money there. So we identified those three groups as the groups that gave him the money, which is a real long way of answering your questions. What did Bill Clinton get? He got support. He got tactical surprise, throwing the Republicans off. But when they discovered that their Republican stronghold in South Florida was tilting to the Democrats, or at least leaking to the Democrats, and he got, probably due to his friendship circle, more money out of the New York Wall Street group than any candidate had gotten before. The Cubans wanted a strong Fidel line. The Wall Street money, I don't know. I don't know that you can put a quid pro quo, even a spiritual one, alongside that money. That seems more friendship-driven, and they were just impressed. And maybe it's a little generational. They liked a young guy, because these were the younger Wall Street people. And the Stevens money is Stevens money. It's Arkansas money, Arkansas oil money.
So you have the Bush people and the Clinton people getting a lot of money, soft money, through wealthy individuals, corporate money. Now, we've got an alternative. We have Ross Perot, who says he put his wallet on the table for us.
Yes.
And he's not only isn't he taking any kind of special interest money, but he's not even taking the $55 million that the government gives you.
No.
When you run, which both Clinton and Bush have taken. That's taxpayer money. What do you think of the Perot approach to campaign financing, which is you just write out a check to yourself?
Well, it's not available to too many of us, but for a while it looked like he was getting away with murder, because here he promised at the outset to pay for the campaign himself, and then he shows up at venues where it doesn't cost him a penny. He shows up at Larry King, Good Morning America, CBS This Morning, and so on. And he shows up at places where they set out the chairs, they set out the lights, they set out the drinks, they set out the candy, and he doesn't have to pay a nickel. And he rides to considerable fame and attention on no money. And until October, well late into the election, when he rejoined, people assumed that he got in and gotten out with a pledge to spend, but didn't spend anything. However, the tightwad that he was is not the tightwad that he remained. He switched gears and is now spending money at a rate that has never been seen in the history of American politics. The media campaign that he is mounting is going up in volumes of millions of dollars per week. He spent, I think, $18 million in 2 weeks, in the first 2 weeks of October, and is close to doubling it again. And when you turn on television, he's on with half hours, he's on with hours, he's on with 60-minute ads and 60-second ads and 30-second ads to promote the 60-second ads to promote the half-hour ads. He's on at many of the breaks now in morning television. You watch Good Morning America, Ross Perot has bought the entire run to the election. You can see him every morning and sometimes in several breaks. He's always on, which will be a really interesting test, I think, of the value of inundating the audience with television advertising, what it gets you.
Do you find it ironic that Ross Perot, who's running as a kind of populist, is one of the wealthiest people in history, probably? It's a little contradiction.
It is a contradiction, and as anyone who looks at it a little closely can notice, he may be running as some character out of a 1930s Hollywood movie, but in fact, he has been one of the most active users of his money in previous elections. I think in 1974, he was the single biggest contributor to political campaigns of that year. He was a Duane Andreas of that year. He has tried to buy, or it appears that he's tried to buy favors for tax breaks and so on for himself, spending tremendous amounts of money on the Ways and Means Committee of the House of Representatives many years ago, and spending it again and again on the Texas delegation.
So although now he's threatening to throw out the alligator shoes, was it, from Congress,
he has hired some of those same shoes in earlier lives, in his earlier life, yes.
I wonder, to wrap up, would you find more disturbing the idea of political candidates getting a lot of special interest money, or the idea of somebody who's so wealthy he could just buy it all himself?
I find the latter more disturbing. Although, at one point in the documentary, there is the question of, does knowing about it bleed the moral difficulties out of it? If you knew, as you can increasingly do, given our laws, that George Bush received this amount from so-and-so, and that amount from so-and-so, and this amount from so-and-so, and then you later learn, as you would learn if you watched our program tonight, that certain apparent favors were given to big donors, doesn't that give you the information where you can say, I hate this, I've seen the information, I make the connection myself, and I vote against this guy? Or does the fact that you know that Ross Perot is rich and that he confesses it and that he says these things like he wants to buy the election, does that mean that, well, he's told you the honest truth, now you can like it or lump it, as opposed to the sneaking that went on before Watergate, where people snuck, literally put money in secret valises and tucked them into secret safes and opened them up in dark corners? I guess it's better that the lights are turned on, but I don't really know that there's any less influence being peddled. And frankly, I don't sense that people are turned off by Ross Perot's money or even terribly turned off by the amount of money that's being spent here. It just seems now to be organically part of the territory. Just money flows when power is being sought in this country. And that's sort of disturbing. But I don't feel any, I mean, I didn't feel any anger. A little bit of embarrassment on the Democratic side when they talked about how they raised money, but joy on the Republican side. Unalloyed joy. There's one scene in the documentary where some common cause demonstrators are standing on a corner and they're yelling what they believe are epithets at people entering a $9 million dinner for George Bush. Fat cats, they yell from the corner. And these people are walking in front of them and turning around and saying, well, I don't know, I could be fatter. Yeah, I'm a fat cat. Look at me. And then they just walk up the street, and they can't even get enough of it. They turn around, go back to the camera, and take even bigger bows for having achieved fat-catedness. Well, if that isn't an epithet, then we're on a whole other planet here. And that's sort of what the documentary describes.
Well, Robert Krulwich, it was great to talk to you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Robert Krulwich is the reporter for a Frontline documentary tonight called The Best Campaign Money Can Buy. It's about campaign financing, and you can see it on public television tonight. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.